today on one of our, a theme very close to our heart, which is the global aspects of the First World War. And I think the title, One in Six, is particularly pertinent in the fact that one in six people involved in combat in the First World War were from the Indian subcontinent. And that's something we really want to draw out through our exploration of the next 5 years of our programme. Let me introduce our speakers today. We're joined by William Spencer, Principal Military Specialist from the National Archives. William joined the National Archives back in 1993 after a career in the Royal Navy, and also is our Chief Specialist on the First World War and advisor to our First World War 100 programme. Also joined by Jahan Mahmood, who's an independent researcher in the First World War, who's been advisor recently to the BBC and some of their programming on India in the First World War, and we're delighted to welcome you here today. So let me hand you over to William Spencer.
Thank you, Rachel. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'll give you a little bit more background relating to the National Archives, because otherwise you might think that I'm talking in a different language. All of our material is identified by the government department that created it, and then what's called a series, which is a generic collection of like material, and then that series is broken down. So all of our material has a three-part reference, some letters, some numbers, and some more numbers. Now, of all the great offices of British government, we have one thing missing, which is significant to what we're talking about today, which are the records of the India Office. So you had the Admiralty, the War Office, the India Office, the Treasury, the Cabinet Office, and so on and so forth. The India Office material is actually held by the British Library. It was offered to the Public Record Office, as it was in the late 60s, but we turned it down, so it ended up in the British Library. We do duplicate to a certain degree what the India Office hold, but there is a split, and you may need to go from one place to the other. But the advice is available either via our website, National Archives, or the British Library website, so you can at least start with looking at the relevant websites. So there are a number of different things relevant to Indian personnel in the National Archives. Some key materials, some medal records, some records of service, operational records, and some details relating to casualties. The interesting thing about the personnel who took part in the First World War from the Indian subcontinent, there's a difference in cultures in many cases. A lot of their stories are through oral history, whereas people of European descent are more likely to keep pieces of paper and so on and so forth, tangible things between the individual, what they experienced, and now. And it's those signposts, in many cases, that can be used to apply to our records. So if you have a piece of paper, a photograph, a medal, in many cases it's the signpost which can open the doors and what we actually hold at the National Archives at Kew. So, for example, a tangible thing, a medal. This is the thing that actually got me into the archives over 30 years ago. I've been a collector of medals for over 40 years. So this is an Indian Order of Merit, second class, given to Indian native soldiers in the First World War and before, and including into the Second World War period. So it's an award for gallantry, something for service above and beyond. But of course, if you have one in your possession, it may help you open the doors into our archives. So there are lots of different ways, what I call the path into our archives. So, for example, somebody joins the army in the broadest sense, whether we're talking about somebody joining Skinner's Horse in the Indian Army, or somebody, for example, joining the Warwickshire Regiment. You're still enlisting. It's the beginning of your career. And then, as you see down the left-hand side, discharge. So the end of their service. So whether their time expired, they discharged a pension, or they died in service. Unfortunately, it's a factor in the First World War that plenty of people did die. And the Royal Navy, for example, used the term discharged dead. So it was just signing off the end of their career. But from that path down the left-hand side, you get documents, you get pictures, you get medals, you get other items. something which you may think is not important, but with a little bit of scrutiny and a little bit of expert help, it may help you unlock something to then apply to their records. And then, of course, down the right-hand side, you do have the oral history element. Whether you're talking about, obviously, what people said to their fathers and then they pass them down, or their children. There's a statement of called Chinese whispers, where obviously a statement at the beginning, when it's retold and retold and told, it can change. So you have to be very, very careful. I always recommend write it down. So, another tangible thing. Unlike the Indian Order of Merit, this is an Indian Distinguished Service Medal. Now, obviously, you can identify that you have the effigy of George V on the left-hand side, and it says, obviously, for distinguished service. But one of the great things about medals granted by the British government to, obviously, British service personnel, Indian service personnel, Australians, Canadians, South Africans, the big thing that sets them apart from almost every other nation is that they are named. So that Indian Distinguished Service Medal is named around the edge. So from having that naming, you get obviously the name, the rank and the regiment. So you can start using that information to apply to our material. Something like a photograph may be useful. This is the photograph of George V presenting a Victoria Cross to an Indian soldier at Brighton Pavilion, where they housed a large number of Indian Army wounded during 1914 and 1915. You may have campaign medals like that in your possession, whether you have all three or just one. So from the left, we have the 1914 star, so all the Indian Army contingent who arrived in Marseille in September 1914 and then travelled up north towards Belgium, they all received the 1914 star, which is the medal on the left, the British War Medal, the one in the middle, and the Victory Medal, the one on the right-hand side. They are all named. It's the signpost. It keeps coming back. If you only have one of them, it's just going to help you as a research tool. For all personnel who actually saw service under fire in 1914, they also got the bar to the 1914 star, that little strip of bronze. So it proves that they came under fire. Now, the sad fact is that the majority of records of service for ordinary Indian Army soldiers no longer survive. They were destroyed through neglect. They have just had low level of interest. So what we are left with are, in many cases, things that are held here in Britain, which can help you. That's just a British Army example of a unit war diary. It gives a day-to-day account of the activities of all regiments and corps of the British Army, or under the British Army auspices in the First World War. So you get regiments of the British Army, the Indian Army, Australian, New Zealanders, Canadians, South Africans, East and West Africans, people from Persia, for example. Anybody who put on, in the basic terms, the British khaki and served under the British Crown, there may well be a day-to-day account of their activities. So those unit war diaries, if you can connect a given individual with a given unit, it becomes their diary. Now, a lot of people say that apart from the day-to-day account of the activities of a unit, they are primarily officer-centric. That is not so, and I will show you a couple of examples in a moment. We have a project called Operation War Diary, which is capturing data, it's tagging the unit war diaries. We've started by digitising 2,097 diaries for British personnel, British forces who saw service on the Western Front, including the Indian contingent, the Indian Expeditionary Force contingent that arrived in Marseille in September 1914. So by capturing not only the regiment, where they were and when and what they were doing, people are extracting the names. Eventually, when we have a large amount of material, which is growing by the day, it'll be searchable. You'll be able to look for the name of an individual. You'll be able to look for a type of activity. You'll be able to look for a place. You'll be able to look for a regiment, whether it's a battery of the Royal Artillery, a regiment of Indian cavalry, a regiment of Indian infantry, or eventually when we've done the whole lot, touch wood, the Australians, New Zealand, South Africans, King's African Rifles, West African Frontier Force. It's a huge project. The digitisation of the diaries is the main strand to the First World War centenary project at the National Archives. So moving on, an example of an Indian diary. Now, it talks about the activities of the regiment in the main part of the narrative. You get place and date in most cases down the left-hand side, and then in most cases notes to appendices down the right-hand side. But this actually has a margin note which talks about a sepoy being left behind in Suez because he is sick and he subsequently dies. Now, try as I might, I have not been able to connect and find that individual on the Commonwealth War Graves Commission website. Whether or not he's commemorated on a memorial in Egypt or whether he's actually on Delhi Gate, for example. There are lots of work that needs to be done. But the fact that you can find individuals like that in that diary, it's sad that it's recording the death of an individual and the cause, if you can read it. But it's putting that individual and their contribution into the context of the First World War. It's putting them in a unit, in a place, and on a date. And of course, you can't prosecute a war without the people, wherever they have come from. So an individual's contribution to the First World War is very, very important. That's another example from the same unit war diary of individual casualties. And it's not just a case of the Europeans or the Indian commissioned officers or the Viceroy's commissioned officers, the Jemadars, etc. It does actually talk about the ordinary rank and file, irrespective of race or regiment. Now, there is one project ongoing, looking at one regiment of the Indian Army at the moment, which is looking at extracting all of the names from all of their First World War unit war diaries, which will then pin down everybody who served as far as they can see. So that if you're interested, and I will tell you, the 57th Wales Rifles, if you're interested in somebody who saw service in that regiment, eventually you'll be able to check the database that's been created to say, look, that's somebody who's related to somebody I know, or it's their great-grandfather. So it's an important step forward. It's unfortunate, it's a fact, that it's much easier in many cases, I'm going to contradict myself now, to research somebody who died in the war. This is a panel taken from the Menin Gate in Ypres, which lists all of those service personnel who saw service under the auspices of the British Army, who died during the war and who have no known grave. Interestingly, that all of the panels on the Menin Gate are numbered, and the lowest numbers, panels 1, 1A, up to I think about panel 9, are all regiments of the Indian Army, so they come first. And it's interesting, if you actually sit down and start looking, much as there are plenty of people with the same name who died serving with the same regiments, you get the same in the Indian Army, but what you can do is use the Commonwealth War Graves Commission website to actually pursue your research that little bit further. Now, this is one of the last images that I'm going to put up, simply because this is one of the tangible things that in many cases you're more likely to find. This is a memorial plaque, a dead man's penny, sometimes called, made of bronze, about 6 inches in diameter and about half, quarter of an inch thick. I'm an imperial baby, I don't talk metric. They can cause problems. Of course, if you've got a common name, how do you know that you've got the right one if you just come across a plaque? If you've got an unusual name, fine, easy. But the interesting thing about the memorial plaque, which does cause problems, any man who died as a result of war service in the war up to 7 years after the end of the war, so up to the 11th of November 1925, their next of kin could apply for a plaque. So if they died, for example, in 1924, but they are buried or commemorated in a village, wherever, but they are not buried under the auspices of the Imperial War Graves Commission, as it was, they may not appear on their records. So don't be at all surprised if you have a memorial plaque and you start applying the name to the available databases that you don't find the details relating to an individual. And of course, you will find that these things turn up in auctions, they turn up for sale on eBay, they turn up in car boot sales, they turn up when you least expect them. There is one church which shall remain nameless that has nearly all the villages' memorial plaques to their particular dead displayed in the church. But again, it's a tangible thing between then and now. They're not exclusively men. If you actually look around the edge, it says, "He died for freedom." Women got them as well. And if you find one that says, she died for freedom, you know that you're looking for a woman. A lot of females saw service, for example, in the Merchant Navy. We're almost upon the centenary of the sinking of the Lusitania, for example. So there are plenty of individual women who were in the merchant service, so they served as stewardesses or as cooks, who lost their lives on the Lusitania, whose next of kin received a memorial plaque. But it's a tangible thing between then and now. There are a number of different routes for you to actually do your research. You would be very welcome and openly and warmly received if you visited us at the National Archives at Kew. We do have advice for people on the National Archives website, and there are published sources. It's out of print, but you will probably find a copy of this here in the Birmingham Library. It does cover all aspects of service under the British during the First World War, including the Indian Army, and talks about its key sources. If you are interested in honours and awards granted to the Indian Army during the First World War, you might want to look at this, which is Indian Army Honours and Awards 1914 to 21. It's arranged by type of award, by regiment, and then in alphabetical order. It's quite a useful book because, of course, it's the tangible thing from the medal to the information in the book, and then moving into the records. There are tens of thousands of undiscovered stories amongst our unit war diaries, and I'm just looking forward to seeing some more being discovered from wherever people come in the world. As I've said to many people in the last 12 months relating to the First World War, spilled blood looks the same from whoever it came from when it's on the ground, and bullets and shells didn't discriminate. And I'm now going to hand over to Johan. Thank you.
Hi, good afternoon, everyone. My name is Johan Mahmood, and I'd like to thank the National Archives and Birmingham Central Library for organising this event today. Leah Chapman and Will Spencer, I thank you a lot for coming out. The reason I am very passionate about this subject is I'm a child of the 70s, and I was often asked as a young man of my contribution to Britain, and at the time I had no answer, but today I have so many answers that I think someone would probably die of boredom listening to me, if not want to hit me over the head with something. Why is this important to Birmingham? Well, from my research I've been able to make a number of observations that we have a number of communities here with strong military connections, and those communities come from Pakistan and mainly from India. The Bengalis on the whole played quite a large role in the Merchant Navy, but I want to talk you through some of the connections. I'm going to attempt to make some of the connections. The presentation, unfortunately, is just focused on the European sector, so I'm not going to be doing it any justice whatsoever, so I think that's very important for me to explain that early on. I won't be covering the Mesopotamian campaign or East Africa or Aden, Salonika, Gallipoli, I will just be talking about the Western Front today. I will try a reenactment as well, so I might need a few volunteers. I have a machine gun stashed here behind me, so we can attempt that. So I want to start off with this slide. Germany invades Belgium on 4 August 1914. And what's the response from the King Emperor on that day? Well, he will declare war against Imperial Germany on behalf of the Empire. And for the Indians, it means that they're automatically involved in the war. They have absolutely no say. This is where the majority of the fighting will actually take place, on the Western Front, which is literally a line that cuts across Belgium and France. This is a reminder of what British soldiers were going through very early on in the war. The British Second Corps were caught in a very difficult situation up against a far more superior German army. There were mounting casualties, and now we were looking for reinforcements. Unfortunately, we couldn't find them at home, so we were forced to look abroad. So I'm just going to read out part of the paragraphs that I've incorporated into this presentation. The German army was the best in the world. The British Expeditionary Force, with only 5 divisions in France, hardly counted as an army. The Germans had more machine guns, more artillery, more trained staff officers, and apparently unlimited reserves of men. The British Second Corps, at its last gasp at the First Battle of Ypres, had to be relieved, and there were no other trained British divisions to do the job. Indian troops on the way to Egypt were redirected to France. The first to arrive, the 16,000 British and 28,500 Indian troops of the Lahore and Meerut divisions and the Secunderabad cavalry, landed in Marseille on 26 September 1914. Their arrival was greeted with great enthusiasm. And this is a picture of Sikh soldiers who have docked in the south and are being warmly received by the French people. I'm not sure where people are able to actually distinguish between some of the turbans. There is a very clear difference between the Muslim and, in some cases, Muslim and the Sikh turban. The Hindu turban is a little bit more difficult to work out, and I might have a picture here that I should be able to point out some of the differences. Any idea who this individual is? King George V, absolutely. So I will read out his statement to the Indians. You are the descendants of men who have been great rulers and great warriors. You will recall the glories of your race, Hindu and Muslim. He seems to have left out the Sikhs. We'll be fighting side by side with British soldiers and our gallant French allies. You will be the first Indian soldiers of the King Emperor who will have the honour of showing in Europe that the sons of India have lost none of their ancient martial instincts. Now, interestingly, at the same time, Whitehall was actually not enamoured to the idea of Indians fighting on the Western Front. They were worried that if brown men proved successful fighting white Europeans, they may go over with that confidence and overthrow their masters in India. However, the king's perspective was very different, as encapsulated in that statement. These are some of the warrior traditions. Now, for the Brits, there was a simple classification across India. You were either a warrior or you were among the effeminate races. Now, the effeminate races had more brain. The warriors had more brawn. But you couldn't have both, because only the Brits had that. That was simply the way that they understood these specific groups. So to start off on the left, we have the Pathans, who were Muslim and a pre-Islamic warrior tradition who, when not fighting foreigners, are kicking the living daylights out of each other. So how we thought we were going to somehow defeat them in Afghanistan, a war that lasted longer than World War I and II put together, is completely delusional. And then we have the Rajputs, who are either Hindus or Muslim. Now, interestingly, in this city, we have a strong Pathan populace at about 30,000. Luckily, they're not fighting each other all of the time. But we do know a little bit about their history, because if you do prod them, they do have the habit of coming back, and the aftermath can be a little bit... I can't find the words to explain it. So you have the Rajputs. The Rajputs are Hindu and Muslim. They're also an ancient martial tradition, and the custodians of India, or so to speak, call the custodians of India. Underneath we have the Awans, and the Awans are an entirely Muslim group of people. You will find large groups of Awans in the Punjab in the frontier of what we call Pakistan today. And then we have the Jats, and the Jats happen to be Hindu, Sikh, and Muslim. And in the city of Birmingham, we have many Jats from India, Sikhs, and also from Pakistan. We have a very, very large Jat community. Moving on, some of the other martial traditions, the Garhwalis, who are Hindus, they were originally part of the Gurkha regiments until they had their own regiments in World War I. So known as the Garhwal regiment, you had the Gurkhas, of course. We don't really have, certainly from my research, I've never come across anyone who's a Garhwali that lives in Birmingham, but we have a very strong Sikh community, as I'm sure many of you are aware, and they have a very strong military connection. And actually happened to come from the same areas that we heavily recruited from in World War I and II. This is quite an amazing chrome picture of Indian soldiers. I'm going to try and point out, that's a Sikh turban. As you can see, it crosses like that, and it's quite high. That there is the Hindu turban. It's a bit lower in length, sometimes difficult to differentiate. And this is the Muslim turban. It has a very distinct cone shape. Kulla, they call it, in the middle. Its origins are Central Asian. So these guys are Muslims. In total, 1.3 million men enlisted into the British Indian Army. It started off with an army of about 155,000. So a period of over 4 years, it grows to a huge number. Now, one of the things that is very important to remember here is that the British Indian Army is not entirely Indian. It's also British. There are a number of British regiments who are fighting alongside the Indians. This is a poster from World War I. It is written in Urdu. It would have been observed by many people in what we call the Punjab, mainly in the Pakistan area, as well as India, to be fair. And in Urdu, it's written, Rupaya Banduk Kon Lega Vohi Jo Forge Me Barti Hoga. That basically, who is willing to take up the uniform? Only, and the money, of course, only those that will join the army. That was a recruitment poster from World War I that apparently was printed in Lahore. And it would have been different for different groups. So for the Sikhs, it would be Gurmukhi Punjabi. For some of the, for the Indian Hindu soldiers, it would be in Devangari. So it would... For different groups of people, you would have different posters. Why would they join, I think, is a really important question. Well, a lot of them, the ones that we initially recruited were from the martial traditions, and they had an opportunity to fulfill that tradition of theirs, or that obligation, at the same time drawing in a nominal fee of around 12 rupees, which was not much at all. But they were promised a pension as well. Now, the majority of soldiers actually came from the Punjab. I think a third in total came from the Punjab. In World War I, the area of the Punjab was predominantly Muslim at 52%. And this is a very important point that often gets missed, is that the British Indian Army was not an entirely volunteer force. Conscription was actually imposed under the notorious Lieutenant Governor of the Punjab, Michael O'Dwyer. And his recruitment policies were actually written up by the British press as terrorist recruitment methods. And I think I have a paragraph here that I have incorporated. Yes. So this is David and Missy's book, Indian Voices of the Great War, 1914 to 1918. And let me read out the quote for you. From 1916, various forms of coercion were also used to secure recruits. The government in India discussed conscription, but preferred to employ informal methods of compulsion, especially in the Punjab. Indian officials were told to produce a given quota of men on pain of losing their posts if they failed. Some men were simply kidnapped or their women's folk held hostage until the men enlisted. After the war, the authoritarian governor of the Punjab, Michael O'Dwyer, was even accused of using terrorist methods to find recruits. That wasn't the case with the majority of soldiers, so there's no need for panic. But this did happen. And it happened when the quota wasn't met. And then we also used other methods to bring in Indians. We promised the Indians independence. If you fight for us, we will free you and give you back your country. And that also pushed some of the political classes to try and encourage enlistment in some of their areas. Now, which areas of the Punjab did the majority of soldiers come from? That is an intriguing question that has to be answered. Well, the largest recruitment area in India was Rawalpindi, which is now in Pakistan. It also happens to be the Pakistan military, or the Pakistan Army GCHQ. So that legacy continues. In the city of Birmingham, we have a very large Pakistani community from Rawalpindi. The second largest recruitment area, so if I can try and point out on the map, that there is Rawalpindi, yeah? And just below Jhelum, that's the second largest recruitment area. Now, to turn around and think that they were just Muslims living in this part of the world at the time would be incorrect. There were Hindus and Sikhs that lived in Rawalpindi and Jhelum, okay? Although the cities are now entirely or majority Muslim because of partition. And then some of the other areas, Kamalpur. It's now called Attock. It was named after a British officer called Campbell. Pur meaning the city of. Pur is a Persian word. Then areas like Mianwali, this area here. Lahore. There was a strong contingent from Lahore. And then some of the other areas like Northwest Frontier, Kohat and Peshawar. But the focus today is the Punjab. From the Indian side, Amritsar, Gurdaspur, Hoshiarpur, Jalandhar, Firozpur. These were some of the areas that were heavily recruited that were predominantly Sikh. And we can actually make a number of connections between those recruitment areas and communities that reside in Birmingham today. This is a picture of a bus carrying men of the Lahore Division to the front. This would have taken place in around 1914, October or November. And this was actually the first non-British unit to see action on the Western Front, the men of the 129th Baloch Regiment. The regiment was a majority Muslim regiment, but also had a number of Hindus and Sikhs fighting in its ranks. Interestingly enough, you will see a British officer there. The units would be left by British officers. He's got a chin strap, so he wouldn't have tied that turban himself. And where he was, if he was running, it might come off. He stood next to the lamppost. But he would have had to understand the language and the culture of the men that he's leading. Otherwise, if he doesn't understand the language, of course, they're not going to understand him. And that was very important. And the officers that led these men were remarkably bright and came out of Sandhurst. Now, from within the ranks of the 129th Baloch Regiment, we get India's first Victoria Cross recipient, which is Britain's highest medal for valour on the battlefield. And in this case, it's Khudadad Khan. Khudadad Khan is a sepoy fighting for the 129th Baloch. He originates from a city called Chakwal, which is now in Pakistan. We have quite a strong contingent of people from Chakwal living in this city. And the reason he gets his VC is because on the 31st of October, he holds back a German assault long enough for British reinforcements to arrive. And irrespective of the fact that five men of his detachment lay fatally wounded around him, either by bayonet wound or bullets, that he continues to man his machine gun long enough to safeguard that very strategic location. Now, this is a guy that's really interesting, Govind Singh. There were 11 Indian VC winners in total from World War I. Six of them were Hindu. That's an astonishing number. They're all called Singh, by the way, but they're all Hindus. They're not Sikhs. There are three Muslims, two Gurkhas. Now, I want to read out to you the account of Govind Singh, but before I do that, it's important to make a connection with the 28th Light Cavalry. I have a uniform downstairs on the second floor that belongs to a Muslim soldier who served in the 28th Light Cavalry. So he would have probably known Govind Singh or bumped into him at some point. But he was also connected to the first Indian VC winner, Khudadad Khan, who was a friend of his. So if you want, on the way down, you can see the uniform. Now, I find this guy's gallantry absolutely remarkable, so allow me to read it, please. Initially part of 28 Light Cavalry, served with 2nd Lancers in France. Gobind Singh was a Lance Duffadar, so the equivalent would be a kind of sergeant. In the 28th Light Cavalry, attached to the 2nd Lancers Gardener's Horse when he won the Victoria Cross on 1st December 1917 in France. In the midst of the Battle of Cambrai, when his regiment was cut off and surrounded by enemy, an urgent message had to be sent to the brigade headquarters, giving the position of the regiment. The route was a 6-mile stretch over open ground, under constant observation and enemy fire. Singh volunteered, not only delivered the message, but also undertook a return message and a subsequent one. He survived enemy machine gun fire directed at him on all 3 occasions, although his horse was killed every time. That's pretty amazing. So what he basically did was engineer this plan that as soon as the horse gets shot, he is going to feign death. So he would stand and run and then hit the deck and then get back up and hit the deck. So I was hoping that we could do a reenactment. So I brought my moustache along. See if it sticks. It does. I just need a machine gun. All right, so I need a volunteer to hold a machine gun. And I need a horse. Does anyone fancy being the horse? Percy, you're going to be the horse? Not like last time, like Buckaroo. I ended up in A&D. Right, actually, I think we'd better give it a miss. Running out of time. So these are the actions of Gorman Singh. I find it kind of fascinating because it wasn't your run-of-the-mill VC winner where he's taking out and he's killing the opposition. Here he's literally trying to save his own life and get the message to headquarters. This is a depiction of what some of the men endured and suffered. And as Will rightly and correctly said, that the bullets didn't discriminate. You know, the bullets were completely impartial. They didn't care who the enemy was in this case. And this is a charge. I think this is the 2nd Battle of Ypres. And you can see the German line of fire just mowing down the Indians. And let's not forget that they were being led by British officers. And there were a lot of casualties. And then we had to replace them. And Indians were then being trained up in the lower ranks of the officer corps. A German soldier's account of the Indians. Let's explore that. Today, for the first time, we had a fight against the Indians, and the devil knows those brown rascals are not to be underrated. At first, we spoke with contempt of the Indians. Today, we learned to look on them in a different light. At 100 meters, we opened a destructive fire which mowed down hundreds. But in spite of that, the others advanced. They were in our trenches, and truly, those brown enemies were not to be despised. With butt ends, bayonets, swords, and daggers, we fought each other, and we had bitter, hard work. Just to conclude now, the overall contribution by Armistice Day, 11 November 1918, 1.3 million men will have served in the British Indian Army. They won't entirely be Indian. There's also British soldiers. They will have fought on many major battle fronts: France, Belgium, Gallipoli, Salonika, Mesopotamia, Egypt, East Africa, Palestine, Aden. 100,000 battle casualties and 74,000 fatally wounded. The 2 major recruitment areas were Rawalpindi, which is now Pakistan, followed by Jhelum, which is also today in Pakistan. Britain takes £479 million from the Indians for its war. It has nothing to do with India. And unfortunately, it reneges on its promise of independence to the Indians. So they have to battle it out again until the Second World War, where 2.5 million men will fight for Britain, and we will take approximately $1.3 billion from the Indian Treasury for what is our war and not their war. So why did so many South Asian communities actually come to Britain? And of course, we can't deny and overlook that imperial link. They weren't just economic migrants. There are communities who have very strong military connections. My father came here from Lahore because his brother served in the British Indian Army in Burma. That's why he came. So you have someone here with that personal connection. But this is the slide I want to leave you with now. Certainly from my local research and investigations, that I have found that in this city, we have a large community from the very same areas that we recruited from, and very heavily. So from the Pakistan sector, Rawalpindi, Jhelum, Chakwal, Attock, Shaur, Kohat, Nowshera, and Mirpur, because the majority of Pakistanis come from the area of, or the state of Kashmir, which is now administered by Pakistan. And some of the warrior traditions that are coming from Pakistan, you have the Pathans, the Jat, the Rajputs, the Diwans, among others. For the Indians, we have strong communities from Hoshiarpur, Jalandhar, Amritsar, and a few from Ambala. And the warrior traditions that are prevalent in the city are mainly Sikhs from the Indian sector, but also Jats and Dogras. Dogras can be Hindu, Muslim, and Sikh. We have a number of Dogras who are Hindu and Sikh, if I'm correct. So this is just some of the communities that reside in the city today. And often we walk straight past them without realising the sacrifices that they've made for Britain. And we wouldn't be here today if we hadn't the Indian Army. And they are the words of the Commander-in-Chief of the British Indian Armed Forces, Sir Claude Auchinleck. So I want to leave you with that note. I want to thank everyone very much for attending today's talk. I hope you found it entertaining. Thank you very much.
This podcast is copyright to the National Archives, rights reserved. It is available for reuse under the terms of the Open Government License.